The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I should be writing Season 18, Episode 43. In this episode, we talk to Lily Lanoff in detail. It is ripped directly from the video for our first Spoilers Club episode. So the format's a little bit different. If you'd like to hear the entire episode, check it out at patreon.com/mightymur. Thank you to Lily for your time, and I recommend checking out One for All by Lily Lanoff so you can get the full effect of this awesome interview. All right, we are live. This is very exciting, everybody. This is the very first Spoilers Club. I am Mer Lafferty, and I just noticed I have not turned on a chroma key for my background, so you get to see my green screen. This is the very first Spoilers Club, and I made this overlay myself, so for some reason, even after podcasting since 04 and streaming for a year and a half, I still have a lot of rough edges to sand off or something. But anyway, I am delighted to be here with Lily Lanoff, who has been so patient with me and the author of One for All and willing to be the very, very first person to bring all of her spoilers to the Spoilers Club. Welcome, Lily. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you. And you make it willing. You make it sound like it's a burden to be here. I'm so excited.
Well, it's you know, when you interview authors, the point of the interview is A, you know, help your audience, but B, help the author. You're a debut. We're still dealing with pandemic crap. We want to sell your book. And so if I have somebody on here and, you know, we start out with it's Verdon Jr. who's the killer, very first spoiler, it's like, why would people buy the book? And so I try to avoid spoilers when I interview people. And so that is why you're willing and wonderful to come here, because you're willing to come and tell us how you put all this together, because we're supposed to have fun here, but also this is for writers and they want to know all the dirty secrets. So just in case we have anybody, this is going to be put out later for our Patreon supporters as well. Give us the rundown of One for All. It's not All for One. It is One for All. I've checked several times and only gotten it wrong on my other streams. So I'm going to get it right this time.
Just like an overall summary?
Sure.
Just
yeah.
Quick? Okay. So One for All is a gender-bent reimagining of The Three Musketeers, in which a girl with a chronic illness, and that chronic illness is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, POTS for short. Her name is Tanya. She trains as a musketeer and uncovers secrets, sisterhood, and self-love. And there are lots of swords. And that's my alliteration.
There are a ton of swords. Well, let's go on. Let's start with the chronic illness thing. You've mentioned on Twitter that that aspect of it made it hard for you to sell, and yet it was a very important part to keep in the book.
Right.
So tell me a little bit about that. Like, did editors push back and like say, we want this, but we want to change? Or did they just say outright reject? Or did your agent push back? Or what happened there?
Right. So, no, my agent has always been super supportive.
Awesome.
One for All was not the book that I signed with my agents for, actually. I was signed for a different book that also had disability rep. It was a book of almost only disabled characters, actually. And that did not sell on submission. Technically, it's still on submission. I would love for it to find a home one day. No, when we went out on submission with One for All, we started getting responses that amounted to, and I think probably this amounted to like 60 to 70% of the responses were, we love this book. We love the writing. We love Lily. We love what she stands for. But we don't know how to market this. Or we don't know if there's readership. And I would keep on thinking to myself, well, women dueling in ball gowns with swords is inherently marketable. I think that there's a lot of readership for that.
Yeah.
And the first few times, you know, I just kind of chalked it up to that being the response that I was getting. But then you sort of start to realize what that's code for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that, you know, the readership question is, well, we don't know if there's enough readership if people actually want to read a book about a chronically ill girl, which is ridiculous given the fact that in the U.S. alone, I mean, up to 25 to 30% of the population is disabled. And a lot of that includes chronically ill people.
Yeah.
So we got a lot of pushback like that. We got some pushback that implied that the editor would have wanted it if the main character was from a different marginalized background and not chronically ill. Which is also really heartbreaking because, I mean, all marginalized authors, like, we're pushing against so many obstacles in the publishing industry.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't need to be forced against each other. Like, that's not helpful.
No, you're not the right kind of marginalized that we're looking
for. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that was heartbreaking. And One for All sold, I think, just over a year after it went on submission. So it was a long time. But a lot of ableism. It ended up at the right house with the right editor, and I'm really happy with how everything turned out eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a question from our Discord. It's about the disability. I wanted to ask about the main character's disability and the process it took to write a disabled protagonist, because you don't see that often.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
What was your process?
Mm-hmm. So, I originally started writing One for All back in at the end of 2016, I think it would have been, because it was when I was supposed to be working on my senior thesis. So I only wrote a little bit of it before I graduated because I tried to focus on my senior thesis. But when I started writing it, I tried to make Tanya very different from whom I was, because I felt like, I don't know, I think that because I had a book that didn't sell on submission before that had disabled characters, I thought that if I wanted to sell a book, I had to kind of erase disability and chronic illness, which is a whole nother, I could talk for hours about that. And Tanya was tall and blonde haired and blue eyed and not chronically ill and pretty much the exact opposite of who I am and who I was. And about a paragraph into writing, I realized that I couldn't authentically write this story, specifically this gender bent reimagining of the Three Musketeers story, because as long as I've been fencing since I was 9, 10 years old. And I got POTS. I was diagnosed when I was 14, but the symptoms started when I was around 12. So POTS and fencing have pretty much gone hand in hand for me for the majority of my life. And I don't really know how to think about fencing or who I am as a fencer without thinking about it through the lens of chronic illness, because I was only a fencer without a chronic illness for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I've been fencing for a lot longer than that. So as soon as I figured out that Tanya was going to have a chronic illness, I wanted her to have POTS. I wanted her to have my condition, because when I was a teenager, I didn't have any books about girls like me.
Yeah.
And you start to think, well, is there a reason for that? Is it because girls like me aren't capable of being main characters, aren't capable of, you know, saving the world and of dueling in ball gowns and fighting dragons or riding dragons or befriending dragons, or, you know, you start to internalize so much of that. And so, and that also, that internalized ableism and internalized shame is a huge part of Tanya's story. And I knew that I wanted to provide the representation that I needed, but didn't get. And to be fair, I still need. And once I decided that, writing about Tanya having POTS was easy, but also incredibly difficult in the sense that I knew exactly what I was writing about. I knew exactly the same, the symptoms. I knew the feelings that she was feeling. But also I was opening up old wounds that hadn't really healed properly. So it was emotionally difficult, but the actual craft aspect, the act of writing about the illness was very easy.
Well, one thing that got me was, I'm like, what does Tanya have? What does Tanya have? And I realized this is hundreds of years ago. There's not going to be a name for it. She's not going to spell it out for me. And so, I watching you try to describe this illness only through symptoms and not through, well, it's a problem with the neurology or the brain or whatever, like we hear now, I was just wondering if you ran up against any, man, if I could just say it's a spinal thing or a nerve thing or whatever, but I gotta go around it and just say she's sick. Was that a challenge, or was...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Because POTS is, you know, it is a disorder of the autonomic nervous system, you know, it, not being able to reference blood pressure.
Yeah.
I can kind of get around a heart rate issue because you can feel your heart rate saying, and that's something that, I mean, you read about in books and people write about in every genre.
That's why the pants worked. I was going to ask about why the pants worked.
Yes. So the pants, okay, so the pants that Tanya wears are my 17th century French fantastical version of compression socks.
Okay.
Which my chronically ill folks who are watching will know what I am talking about, especially if you have POTS or EDS or any other blood pressure related issue. Now, to be fair, there wasn't actually fabric at the time in France that they would have access to that mimicked compression of fabric. But that's why it's historical fantasy and
that's
not
right.
Historical fiction.
Exactly. So I do want to get to some of the spoilers here. You have done something that is... we got one from Daniel. Assuming I'm correct in assuming Thale was meant to have ADHD, also she would not have been diagnosed back then. She just is flighty, easily distracted, who hyper-focuses on her hobbies like the compression pants. So are you delving into neurodiversity there too?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to be fair, I have ADHD and I'm a neurodiverse author. So, I mean, and I don't like regularly talk about that a lot because I've been talking about chronic illness and POTS a lot because that is the focus of the book. But no, I mean, if we want to talk about neurodiversity, I mean, listen, Tanya has anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's she has panic attacks in the novel.
Yes.
Thea has some form of ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Aria is neurodiverse.
Yes.
I don't know. I've had people read her as autistic. I've had people read her and like a number of other things. Portia, I don't know. I think that it's hard because as a neurodiverse author, my brain works a certain way, and I think that some part of all my characters are neurodiverse because my brain doesn't really know how to write neurotypical characters.
Yeah. I see that a lot in authors. A lot of people, at least in our more vocal Discord, talk about ADHD. I was diagnosed as an adult, and I'm just seeing, I see it everywhere, and I'm like, you're a creative person, aren't you? And just really, I think that's one of our superpowers, but it does, you know, comes with a lot of other crap. But yeah, we did a lot of, as Kay Kimmy says, woo ADHD club. So yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's your different characters are awesome. Did enjoy all of those. Now, I have to admit that I have not read The Three Musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious how much of personalities you brought over from that, or if they're just, if they're entirely new characters.
See, that's, I love that you asked that question specifically, because I've had a lot of people who have brought up the fact that the plot feels very different, which is intentional, because I did move the time period. It's not the same. It's about around 30 years later from the initial Three Musketeers. And the reason why I wanted to do that in the first place was because I felt like there wouldn't be new ground for me to tread in terms of the whodunit aspect. Mm. And also this like little 2-3 year period between La Fronde, the French Civil War, and Versailles. Almost nobody writes about it because, to be quite frank, Versailles is a lot more interesting and flashier and more fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of room to move around in this kind of little 2-year long span, 3-year long span. As far as the characters are concerned, I really wanted them to feel like their own people. I didn't want them to feel like complete mirrors of the original characters. So what I did was I mapped their character traits in ways that were more abstract than concrete. So the example that I usually refer to is Portia and Porthos. In the original novel, The Three Musketeers, Porthos is described as larger than life. He drinks a lot. He eats a lot. He sleeps with a lot of women. Is very lusty. He's very hungry. And Portia is very hungry, but in an abstract sense. She's hungry for women's rights. She's hungry for what she wants. She knows exactly how she's going to get it. And I think of her as a, you know, I think that Tanya even at one point describes her as ferociously hungry just for everything that she wants. And I kind of took that. That was kind of the model that I was using. Because also, I mean, these are, you know, men in their 20, you know, mm-hmm. late teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, and teenage girls. So I wasn't going to have them be exactly the same. And then I did my best to have familiar character names, but that was really difficult because the original Three Musketeers character names, those aren't the actual Three Musketeers names. Those are their nicknames. So they're not French names.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a week kind of crying over my computer, trying to find potentially historically non-anachronistic names, girls' names from the 17th century France that kind of sounded like Latinate names that were not from this time period and not at, oh my gosh. So it was rough.
So you've got our classic sort of I guess it's sort of a love triangle, although it doesn't feel like it because the two men never interact. But you do have the hotter of the men turns out to be the bad guy, but it takes a while for Tanya to accept this.
Mm-hmm.
How often did he? I think I missed whether he was actually there in the first scene at her house. Was he one of the guys there?
No.
No, okay.
No, he was
okay.
Not.
So he sent somebody. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But did you find it, do you find it difficult to write I've not written a love triangle before, so what can you tell us about crafting that and keeping it, what are my words? Up in the air, and because you really did, you could tell she had feelings for Henri, but she was seriously falling for Verdun. So, how do you craft that?
Right. So, for Tanya, I thought about it less of a love triangle, because for Tanya, you can I think the reader can tell that she has feelings for Henri, but I don't think that Tanya can tell. Tanya's just really not. And I think that, you know, some people have described her as naive, but I think that it's mostly because, I mean, she's a 16-year-old girl who is chronically ill and has grown up in a town who have told her pretty much that because of that, no boy is ever going to be interested in her.
Yeah, there's no love in her life. That's what her mother says. Don't look for
Right.
love. There won't be any.
Right. So she doesn't really know how to deal with a lot of the feelings going on inside of her. I mean, and you know, it's hard enough, you know, as a teenage girl trying to navigate feelings.
Right.
And then you add in the fact that you're chronically ill and that complicates it even more. And then you add in the fact that Tanya's in 17th century France, and that adds on a whole new aspect to it. So for Tanya, I really wanted her and Henri's relationship to be more about a friendship first and foremost, and in terms of like building trust. I mean, she's obviously attracted to him when she first sees him, but then again, she as she brings up, she's like afraid that she's cursed to blush, you know, whenever some like a boy her age talks to her, because she just doesn't have the opportunity to actually talk to other boys in her town because there aren't any. I wanted their relationship to be incredibly slow building, but I wanted to show a healthy aspect of how their relationship grew, versus her relationship with Etienne, with Verdun Jr. Verdun knew exactly, like he, I really wanted to use Verdun's character to interrogate the kind of character that YA readers are encouraged to, you know, like in love triangles. Because I think that, and I have, you know, friends who are like, oh no, but I loved like Etienne, like the bad boy, he's so great. And I really wanted to kind of unpack that, because at the end of the day, at the end of the book, when Etienne says that he loves Tanya, he believes that he loves Tanya. That's not a
Yeah,
lie.
I
Like
got
he
that.
actually does.
Yeah.
But it's not, I don't think of it as love as an author, because I don't think of love as something that is like, at least I don't want to portray love as like, I don't know, healthy love as something that's destructive. And it's not healthy the way
Right.
that he views love and the way that he thinks about love and talks about love and believes love, what love is. For Tanya, her falling for Etienne was very quick. And I think that, you know, there's this element of he is the first boy who has ever really validated her, who has ever told her that she's beautiful, who has ever really shown interest in a concrete way. Because with Henri, he's so bumbling and nervous, and I think that Tanya doesn't see what's right in front of her a lot of the time because he's not explicitly obvious. For Tanya, you have to be like, I like you, Tanya. And even then, sometimes it just doesn't register, because I
What's
mean,
your
to be fair,
angle there? What do you mean
yes,
by like?
because to be fair, I mean, wh and this has to go comes back to her own experiences and also just being chronically ill. I mean, you know, whether it's, you know, Marguerite, her best friend from before ghosting her,
Oh, yeah.
you know, 17th century French fantasy version. You know, she's used to people leaving her or people deciding that she's not worthy. So to have somebody who is reaffirming that over and over again and having that kind of undercurrent of, well, actually, he's not behaving in a way that he should be. He's keeps on apologizing for things and never actually changing his behavior. And that was the one thing that I really wanted to hit home, in that so when readers could go back, they could find the kind of the trail of breadcrumbs in terms of how he in his deception, in how he would, and in how he manipulated her, and how he wasn't. I mean, obviously he wasn't honest, but the way that he acted, you know, he knew exactly what he was doing.
Right.
And then also the, you know, I also really wanted, because I wrote started writing One for All right around the time of the Me Too movement started taking hold. Mm. And I wanted to talk, because I don't think that it's possible to write a gender-bent reimagining of the Three Musketeers in which teenage girls are seducing men out of secrets without talking about consent. You can't write that novel without talking about consent. All the girls talk about consent and have, you know, versions of consent. Arya is touch averse, and that's made, like, you know, clear early in the novel. Thea has her own backstory when it comes to her previous experience with sexual harassment and sexual assault. Tanya has, you know, kisses at 10 and has this, you know, romantic, what she believes is a romantic first kiss moment. And then later, when she talks about it with the other musketeers, with the other girls, and she starts thinking about the situation that she was in and the fact that she had no opportunity to say no, and the fact that she was sick, but also that he knew that she was sick. He knew that she was feeling really unwell, but kissed her anyway. Mm-hmm. And didn't think to wait until she wasn't dizzy, until she wasn't sick. And so, you know, I wanted, but by the end of the novel, I wanted the love triangle aspect to kind of break apart or kind of crumble apart in terms of, not that Tanya's feelings necessarily go away. And I mean, if I ever get to write a One for All sequel, which I would love to do, I already have lots of plans.
Good, because that's been a question for several people. Someone in chat asked if that meant that Versailles was open for a sequel. You're talking about the little scrap mm-hmm. of 2 years. You look very coy right now.
What I will say is this. I would be lying if I didn't have a sequel title, a sequel synopsis, and sequel pages written.
Excellent.
However, One for All was purchased as a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get to decide whether or not I write a sequel. It's up to the publisher.
We talk about that here a lot on I Should Be Writing.
And it's personally, I mean, I love my publisher. I do. Mm-hmm. I think I haven't talked a lot about my feelings about it. I mean, I've said how much I would love to write a sequel, but I think I would be pretty heartbroken if I didn't get to write one, because I want to show Tanya healthily exploring romantic connections. Mm-hmm. I want to show her having gone through this journey of overcoming internalized ableism. I want to show her at a point where she is actually learning to love herself and not really doubting herself as much. And I think that that's a really important message and story to share with readers.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I have lots of story plans that perhaps involve the King of France and Thea and like lots of other little goodies. But like, I really hope that it happens. I really do. That's all
so
I can say.
My question is, as someone who's never been able to be an actress or pretend about hardly, I wear my emotions on my sleeve a lot. And the idea of, you know, seducing men and not like pulling it off, the manipulation, and not falling for them just felt, I felt like Tanya entirely. Like that, I totally would have fallen for him too. I mean, it's, that is just how I thought. And I thought, okay, my first question is, didn't they have a way to deal with that? I mean, I could tell it's like, don't fall for your target, but it felt like you're dealing with teenage girls, and in a world where they've been told forever that, you know, snagging a man is your only way to continue living. And it just, I felt like, I don't know, Tanya was thrown into the deep end, and I'm not putting this, like, bad storytelling on you, but I'm like, what was, and I can't remember her name, I didn't write that one down.
Madame de Trivi.
Yes, what was she thinking? And now that we know there's, like, a romance building between Tanya and Henri, we also know that Tanya has proven herself to the Musketeers.
Mm-hmm.
How is Henri going to act when she does her next job?
Yeah.
I suppose that's going to be in the plot.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's a huge, yeah. That would be a huge part of the next book, if it, the next book is
Excellent.
Written. I think that, no, but you hit the nail on the head. It's that Madame de Trivi really does throw Tanya into the deep end. She does not take into account Tanya's very specific circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Portia's a lesbian, so she's not falling for any of the male targets.
Yeah.
Arya is demisexual and she's bi, so she also is not falling for any of the targets in her own, like, in her own experience of her demisexuality is not falling for any of her targets.
Just to make it clear, demisexuality is not discussed very much.
I Should Be Writing is available to you under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Theme music by John Anilio. Art by Numbers Ninja. Production by Summer Brooks. And hosting by Libsyn. Find all of this information and more at Merverse.com. And remember, we can't do this without you. Thanks for your support. Doctor. Yeah, I'm sitting home watching Doctor.